He's just a fabulous specimen. Very fast for a unit. Kolasinac is definitely one that doesn't need to go to the gym.
Welcome back to the Squawker Talker podcast, the first Monday podcast of the new season. I'm your host, Greg Johnson. To celebrate this wonderful fact that we're going back to two a week, we've got two of our best loved regulars back in the room. Greg Lee's back. How you doing, Greg?
Yeah, good, thank you, Greg.
How was your summer?
Yeah, really nice, thank you. But looking forward to the season now.
I think we all are. I think we're all a bit done of the constant monotony of transfer rumours and all the rest of it. How are you, James? James Bench. I should probably introduce you before saying hello. It's James Bench from the London Evening Standard.
I'm great. I'm glad to be back. I heard my shout out at the end of the last episode, so I know that big things are expected of me.
Oh, always.
I feel like a £50 million striker. £80 million striker, I believe.
Because £50 million is not a lot anymore.
£50 million gets you Shane Long.
The Spanish Shane Long, as some people have called him, Alvaro Morata.
Maybe that's what I was...
Maybe that is. But as we start the podcast, I want to know your winners and losers of the weekend that's just been. Obviously, in England, it was a Community Shield. Some people, it's a friendly. Some people, it's the biggest trophy of all time. But who are your winners and losers, James?
I was at the Community Shield, and I don't really want to talk about it more than I have to. So my winner of the weekend is going to be a bit of a left-field choice, only because I spotted it this morning, but Clinton and G., formerly of Tottenham fame, or Tottenham, maybe not Tottenham fame, two goals, not necessarily of the highest quality, but two goals for Marseille at the weekend as they won, and quite a good performance by all accounts. Really surprising, because I just thought he was someone that was going to really slip off our radar, but I think Ligue 1's a league that suits him, and he always looks so sad at Tottenham. Like, he really looked like a player that was like, Premier League's not for me, is it? I'm not, and Mauricio Pochettino's not being nice to me. But yeah, I thought he had a really good weekend. It was between him and Connor Washington, who also scored two goals. I didn't see anyone score a hat-trick, so I just went for the players that got braces.
I think David Villa scored a hat-trick on the other side of the Atlantic. Well, who are your winners and losers? Well, we've had the winners from James. Do you want to bring some losers, Greg?
Yeah, my loser, I'm going to go for poor old Claudio Ranieri, actually. His non-team, his first game in charge, and they lost 3-0 to Marcelo Bielsa's Lille. And it's kind of like Ranieri, he obviously loves what he does, so he wanted to keep going, but I wonder in a year's time, will we look back and think maybe the time to call it a day was after, I know it ended badly with Leicester, but still such a historic achievement, and Nantes, it doesn't look like they're going to do much in terms of challenging for any silverware or anything like that. So yeah, poor old Claudio takes it for me.
Probably should have called it a day when, what was his name? Whatever the tenor was. The second that tenor started singing.
Andrea Bocelli just going,
yeah. It's not going to get better than this, is it?
This is literally the end credits to a film.
Exactly.
Actually, just call it a day there and then. But yeah, Bielsa, Lille. Oh, already looks pretty exciting. 3-3-1-3. He's literally going back to the kind of Bielsa-shaped mould that everyone expects of him.
Yeah, some interesting signings, young players. They'll definitely be top by November and maybe sixth by the end of the season, I think.
They've got the director of football in place who basically made Monaco what they are, so... Who knows? It could be an interesting time in Lille. But yes, it was the return of Ligue 1 this weekend. Monaco won 3-2, PSG won 2-0, but without Neymar, who wasn't allowed to play because I think the Spanish authorities didn't send his registration.
I'm really surprised the Spanish authorities have done that. I mean, they've been so eager to chivvy this one through nice and quickly. Did they use the same fax machine that they sent the De Gea paperwork?
Possibly, yeah. Maybe they were trying to send the Neymar stuff. They really were, and then the De Gea bit came in instead, and it was like, you know, when you send a printer job and about 50 pages come out first. Maybe it was that.
I think so. I think they're really disappointed.
Yeah, we should give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, absolutely.
The poor lambs. And as we said, Marseille 3-0 win over Dijon with a Clinton and G becoming Superman. Off the bench, replacing Dimitri Payet, interestingly, who was subbed after a disappointing first half. And NG comes on and just basically runs them to pieces. So one to look out for there. I believe he was player of the week, according to L'Equipe, who are notoriously stingy on their player ratings.
Yeah, 5 out of 10, was it then?
Yeah.
The player of the week.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's 6 out of 10.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. An unforgettable performance.
Oof. Beautiful. In the German Super Cup, Bayern beat Dortmund on penalties. I'm not entirely sure if they used the ABBA system, which I'm going to talk about with you guys shortly.
I'm really excited to talk about the ABBA system.
Yeah? Well, how many puns did you come up with in the press box?
My favourite was...
Obviously, the winner takes it all. I mean, we've all got that.
Knowing Giroud. When Thibaut Courtois blazed over, that was an early SOS. I'm actually stealing all of these from the Press Association's Mark Manbryans, who was on top ABBA form.
Very, very nice. It's... Yeah, you can really sort the wheat from the chaff of who knows that happened and who doesn't.
Oh, weekend, yeah.
Which is what you want from a Community Shield showdown, really.
I mean, I'll be frank, the members of the press pack often have a sort of partridge-ish tendencies, myself included in that. And they were all the more evident this weekend. But, I mean, if we're going on to talk about it, the ABBA system, can I say I'm a massive fan of it.
Yeah.
I think it was just that when Courtois skied his penalty over, suddenly you were kind of looking at Morata going, mate, the pressure's like really on you.
Yeah.
If you mess this up, like it does just seem to heighten the drama.
Mm.
I think they also say it favours the team that goes second. I don't know why. I
think the idea is it just favours the team that goes first less. I think
59% seems to be the figure that is currently favoured the team who goes first.
Mm.
So it's obviously a slight advantage. So trying to even that out, I think, isn't it?
Mm. And there's a few ideas of how to improve penalties. The one I like was one that I think called the advantage. It was called where you do the penalty shootout before extra time. And then the team that wins penalty shootout therefore has the advantage, almost like you would in tennis in a way. And then the team that hasn't won the penalty shootout has to win the extra time.
I quite like that.
Mm. It's a bit complicated, though. You can imagine, I mean, you look at the outrage of ABBA. I'm not meaning the music. This is going to be a very confusing thing for the rest of the podcast. But a few people saying, oh, they're making football too complicated with this ABBA system. Mm. Imagine if they brought the advantage in or something like that. I think people would just be not get it.
To be fair, it's not just the sort of people on Twitter that were finding it complicated, because Nacho Monreal walked up to take the third penalty and like half of his Arsenal team were going, Nacho, what are you doing? And then Nacho just turned around and was like, oi, this is my penalty.
Yeah.
And then just leathered it into the top corner. So, yeah, the footballers are still struggling with it. I think we might have some teething problems, but I like it. I like the drama. I like the fact that like if you miss that first penalty of the two, the second one is just like, oh, don't miss it, Alvaro Morata.
It just adds, as you say, adds more pressure, a bit more drama.
Much to Michy Batshuayi's amusement as well.
I saw he just
tweeted that just as we were on the way in, actually, that he wasn't laughing at that, of course. He'd never do that, so.
Of course not.
We'll have to try and get to the bottom of what actually happened there.
Mm. Any thoughts? What it could be?
Not really, no.
Were there any kind of Belgian jokes in the, from Courtois, maybe?
Possibly, but I don't think he was in shot, so maybe he just remembered something funny from the other day.
Probably just some bants with Chalobah, wasn't it?
Maybe.
Over WhatsApp.
Can you bring your phone onto the pitch?
Why not?
Why not?
Ben Foster had an iPad once, didn't he? I think it was an iPad for the penalty shootout, so maybe.
And Totti had an iPhone.
This is true.
Or did he have to go and get the iPhone?
I think someone threw it in from the crowd.
I've not got an issue with that. I mean, the whole thing is like people say managers don't really get that much. I can't really influence the game that much. But if you had a group chat going and everyone had, I mean, you'd need like an Apple Watch.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you? And then you just check the watch.
Other brands are available. unless they stop paying us, and then we'll definitely
talk about the Apple Watch is the best. If anyone wants to send us some free ones.
But as much as you said you don't want to talk about this game, this is our game of the weekend. Arsenal beating Chelsea on penalties 1-1 at Wembley. Arsenal now 9 out of 9. For matches at Wembley.
I did not know that.
That's you know, oof. Arsene Wenger's quietly playing the blinder on the big games.
When's the North London derby?
Oh, that's a good shout.
They should move there. Every other London team is having their season at Wembley.
Yeah.
They could be like, they could beat the Invincibles record. Mm.
But is there any sense that in a kind of a, we've all seen The Ring and similar J horror films, haven't we? Is there any sense that when Chelsea beat Spurs at Wembley in that semi-final, the curse was kind of moved onto them in a kind of, they watched the video and now the little girl in the well is coming to get them and she's ringing their phone and they're going, oh, we can never win at Wembley again. Is that what's happening, Greg?
Yeah. To lose twice to Arsenal as well, like, well, one on penalties, but they've normally got such a good record against Arsenal, haven't they, in the big games. So, yeah, possibly. We'll have to see when they go to Spurs, which I think is the second game of the season. So,
yeah,
we won't have long to find out.
Yeah. How do you reckon the Wembley effect is going to affect things in the top six this season?
I mean, I think it's going to massively harm Spurs because, I mean, you go to White Hart Lane and then you go to Wembley and the pitch is vast. And if you think what Pochettino's style is built on, that relentless pressing, I mean, I think after a while the players will adapt to it and get even fitter. But, I mean, that's basically what's going to be demanded of them. You've got to be even fit because I think they worked it out at something like 10 to 15% more surface area they're going to have to cover. So either Pochettino has to adapt his game plan or
buy loads of wingers.
Buy lots of wingers.
Don't think they're going to buy anyone, are they? So.
No.
We are going to get onto that a little bit later on, but it is looking a little bit, you know. I mean, I get it. They've got the most settled team in the division. But, I mean, we've always seen the best managers always like to strengthen position strength. I think that might be a tautology. Anyway, but you want to bring in extra options, add a bit more competition, keep people kind of unsettled, to keep raising the game. I guess Spurs can't do that, especially if you're going to like loan out guys like Josh Onoma to to other clubs as well. But we'll get onto that again in a little bit. Just to stay on the Community Shield a little bit more, Pedro's red card and the Koscielny-Moses debacle. Obviously, Pedro will be free to play the first competitive game of the season because, according to the FA, I mean, there was a bit of confusion on Twitter about this. The FA were kind of saying it's not a friendly, but it is a friendly. It's a kind of a non-competitive competitive game, isn't it?
I mean, it's pretty simple. Like, I think the FA have come to the conclusion that you shouldn't just get to burn through a game of your ban for a game that neither of the managers are taking seriously. I mean, I know what you mean. I got loads of people kind of chatting. I mean, no, you're wrong. You're wrong.
It's like, people really love the Community Shield,
but like, I'm sorry, I just asked the question. You know, you go to people and you ask the question and they tell you the answer. But anyway, sorry, this is Twitter politics. I just don't want to talk about
it. I got told you were a fraud journalist because I said that, oh, James, but I just also spoken to the FA about this and stuff. People just, I don't know.
It's just like...
Are you fake news, James?
I'm fake news. the simple reality is like, it doesn't really matter. Like that. It doesn't matter for Wenger. Like, Arsenal are never going to play Koscielny anyway because if he's banned for the first two games of the season, the whole point of this was kind of settling in that back three, which didn't work out ideally with Mertesacker taking a giant elbow.
Oh, yeah.
That was horrible. He had a huge, huge cut on his face. It's not a nice sight. But yeah, it's a friendly game. Mm. Arsenal played their B team. You know, the players who could have been risked, like Mustafi and Sanchez, there wasn't even a consideration from Wenger that he would play it. So it has no status. It's just an irrelevance. So also, therefore, if Morata or Lacazette scored, no, it's not Golden's debut. They'll make their debuts this weekend. Don't worry, everyone.
But Kolasinac might want to think of that as his debut because he was very good, wasn't he?
He is absolutely... I mean, like, you know, I've jokingly kind of decided to change my own account into a Kolasinac fan account because he's just a fabulous specimen. Wenger said there are sort of some people that need to go to the gym and some people that don't. Kolasinac is definitely one that doesn't need to go to the gym. It's just like carved out of oak. And he's also combines that with some really like kind of high quality ball skills. Mm. He's very fast for a unit his size. And you know, a great header for that goal. Mm. He was absolutely fantastic.
Mm. Greg, you're a regular watcher of Serie A and a bit of an expert on all things Juventus, I might say. You look at a player like Kolasinac, obviously he went to Arsenal on free. Chelsea have been chasing Alexandro all summer. How much would Conte have wanted a player like Kolasinac down his left flank?
Yeah, it's strange. It seems to have gone quiet on both Alexandro and Chelsea's kind of win-back targets in general. So, yeah, Conte's clearly not too happy at the moment with how things have gone. And back to his Juventus days, that was always a theme. He's someone who obviously wants things done his way. And if there's any slight deviation from that, he's not happy. Mm. The way he left Juventus was kind of over transfers. It was obviously a bit further down his managerial career there than it is at Chelsea, but even so, it does go to show that all is not maybe as well as it would have seemed when you look back to kind of May when they're lifting the trophy.
Mm. But there has been comparisons drawn both with what happened at Juve and also the dark old days of Mourinho's second downfall when he fell out over transfers as well. Do you think there actually is a danger that Conte could walk, that, you know, the worst could happen? He's got this new contract, but it's not actually any longer. He's just getting paid a bit more. What do you make of it?
Yeah, that seems a lot more the case than it should be for a manager who won the title so convincingly last season. You'd think everything would be happy. He'd have all the control. Chelsea, to be fair to them, they obviously need to safeguard, not that they're going to go bust or anything, but they need to be sensible in their recruitment, their kind of long-term planning, which may go beyond Conte's spell at the club. But yeah, I don't see him leaving yet, but you wouldn't be too surprised if things went badly this season if that was it.
I think it's a real problem, and I mean I kind of think that there's a tendency, because he was so fantastic in taking Chelsea to the title, to absolve Conte of a lot of the blame here. But kind of the way he's managed his squad and managed the transfer window and managed expectations upwards and downwards is problematic. I think kind of you see it with Nemanja Matic, that they were just like, well, I do not want you at all. Don't bother coming on the tour. And now they have to replace him because they've only got three midfielders. Mm. Because they also allowed, they kind of put Chalobah in a place where he felt like he had no choice to leave. And obviously, we all know the biggest one is Diego Costa, because it looks more and more likely like Diego Costa is not going to go in the summer, or he's not going to go to Atletico Madrid. I think they're a bit reluctant to kind of pay £50 million for a player that they won't be able to use for 6 months. But he's also now not going to play for Chelsea at all, which is mad, because it feels like there's quite an easy compromise, which gives Chelsea the best front line, I was thinking, since kind of the Arsenal and Man United front lines of the sort of late 90s, early noughties. I mean, you could have, you know, Costa and Morata paired up front with, say, Fabregas or Willian in behind. Do that for 6 months. You just say to Costa, yeah, you'll go once, as soon as Atleti's transfer ban is over, you go. You're out the door, but for now, give us 6 more months. I mean, it's not like Costa. You know, we know what Costa's like. He's a relentless competitor. And so Conte's almost left himself in the position where, by isolating so many players, by not giving the youth a chance last season, he's got a squad, I think, of 14 first-teamers.
I think Frank Lampard said, look at the programme. It was half of the amount that Arsenal had.
I mean, it was, you know, you almost think Conte must have rung up Wenger and said, do you want to stick Joel Campbell on that, mate? I know he's not, you know, he's not got a squad number. Stick him on. Go on. See if Michael's looking at the back of that. But Conte's, he's a fabulous manager. He's a fabulous tactician. But the way he's managed Chelsea's players over the last few months has kind of left him in that position. Mm. And now they've got, they want to bring in 4 more players, sort of probably £250 million worth or £200 million worth. I mean, we all talk about Man City spending, but Chelsea are going to have to go kind of huge in the final few weeks, probably to end up with squad players.
Mm.
I'm not rushing to go and be Chelsea's fourth choice, fifth choice centre back or their third, fourth choice midfielder. It's going to be a really horrible month for them, I think.
Mm. And Champions League this season as well,
yeah,
which is a big thing. And going back to Inter Juventus, Conte always kind of struggled. Their league form always came through. They still won the title, but in terms of making progress in the Champions League, they weren't really able to do that. And that was obviously underlined further when Allegri subsequently has taken them to two Champions League finals. So,
And I think, 3 Coppa Italia wins as well?
Yeah. I think if one thing is to go, it will probably be the Champions League. I wouldn't be surprised if they kind of don't make the latter stage of that kind of focus on... They'll make the knockout round, I think, but in terms of the semi-finals, I think that's more likely to go than bombing in the Premier League. But even so, it's another issue to consider.
Just on Conte's kind of squad management, man management, do you think there's anything in maybe cultural differences between Serie A and the Premier League? I remember that there's this great book, The Italian Job, which Gianluca Vialli, I think he started off as Gianluca Vialli's biography, and he wrote it with Gabriel Marcotti. And it ended up basically being like a sociological exploration of Italian and English football and the contrast and all the rest of it. Fantastic book, read it if you haven't yet. But Vialli, what really stood out for me with Vialli is how he said in Italy, football is seen as a job from the very start and people take a much more professional approach to it. There's kind of less emotion to it to some extent in terms of how the players go about it. So do you reckon that maybe Conte was saying, in the way that he said that guys like Shalabar are impatient, his words, for wanting to go out, was maybe he expecting to just shut up and put up and just be what he needs him to be rather than what they want him to be, if you know what I mean? Ask what your club can do for you type.
Yeah, definitely. And he is that type of manager, isn't he? He wants everyone to toe the party line, which is set by him. And maybe that's kind of an English thing as well, in a way, that kind of really all-powerful manager at the top of the club wanting to kind of have things done his way. I think with Juventus and the European thing, it was often not so much a squad depth issue. It was more kind of the approach, which that intensity to get that going once a week is one thing, where you've got all that time in training to focus on the specific opponent you're playing. To do that kind of 2 games a week against top-class opponents in Europe, that seemed to kind of, they came unstuck a little bit with that. It wasn't a disaster in one of the seasons. They got to the quarterfinals, but didn't even make it into the knockouts, the subsequent one. So he seemed to struggle with that bit of it, I think.
Mm. Last bit on Conte and kind of the Juve factor. But obviously, Michael Emenalo is in place at Chelsea. How much was Conte involved in actual squad management at Juventus? Because obviously he had Marotta, I think, taking care of a lot of that for him. Is this maybe a case of Conte's been put in kind of roles that aren't suited to his skills, maybe?
Yeah, possibly. But then the way he left Juve as well, as I said, was, I think Cuadrado was the main kind of one that summer where he really wanted him. Mm. He's obviously gone to Juventus subsequently. But even then, when he won 3 titles at Juve, which looking back now, it seems like anyone could have done. But they were seventh when he took over. They weren't kind of in the position they're in now. So even then, he wasn't fully able to push things through the way he would have wanted. So yeah, it was still a compromise approach at Juve, as it probably is at Chelsea and every club in the world now.
He doesn't seem one that's good at compromising, and I think that could be something that catches him out in the Champions League as well, because sometimes you have to kind of accept drop points somewhere else, and you know, whether that is the League Cup or, which I'm sure he will throw, but whether that's the Premier League. And I, to be honest, I'm of the mind that if they don't add a bit of depth and numbers, they might not even get out of the group stage, because a lot of it depends on when Hazard is back. Without him, that attack really doesn't. They didn't really create a thing against Arsenal.
Yeah,
and I know it's the Community Shield, and I know it's a friendly, but they just don't have anyone to peel a defence apart.
Mm. But they don't, as you said, they don't have Costa either. And even when Hazard wasn't like the match winner last season, Costa was. The one that always sticks in my head is the game against West Brom at home, where it's 1-0. The one chance of the game, Costa just gets it, rolls McCauley, and just shots the ball into the back of the net. I mean, you're going to start the season with Pedro and two unknowns, effectively.
Yeah.
In that front three, I should say.
It's a huge risk, and he was saying, you know, Morata's not ready. He's got work to do. Well, then, you know, why did it take you so long? I know there's the Lukaku thing, but then why did it take you so long to get a centre forward in? Mm. You could have had Lukaku on sort of June the 1st if you'd been a bit more decisive. And then why did you not start Morata from the off in the Community Shield and get him as much game time as possible? You've got a kind of striker who's coming in cold as you're trying to defend the title. It's been really badly managed this summer, and I mean, I think it's a bit. I can't imagine anything goes badly wrong as it did 2 years ago, but I mean, there's a lot of parallels.
But is this then a Chelsea problem rather than a Conte problem?
It's a bit of both. As you say, they've not ever been good at building from a position of strength, have they? How many? I mean, since Mourinho's first spell, I don't think they've ever followed up a title with another title, which was sort of the hallmark of Man United, and that's really who Chelsea aspire to be. And they tend to do things on the cheap. 2 years ago, it was Baba Rahman, Nathan and Begovic.
Djilobodji.
Oh, and Djilobodji.
Kennedy as well, I think.
I mean, Vitesse Arnhem are very grateful for all that summer did for them. But yeah, there's no first teamers in effect. Mm. And they've almost, they're not, it's weird, isn't it? Because you also think, well, they've spent 140 million. They've bought the defensive midfielder that everyone wanted in Bakayoko. They've bought a great striker and a very good centre-back in Rudiger.
But they're also linked to be in for Van Dijk as well.
Yeah.
So are they just going to buy so many defenders they can't be beat and then worry about the rest later?
It's Pulis approach, maybe. Playing four centre-backs.
Maybe that 1-0 win he went, this is very hard to beat. We'll do more of this.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. Do that. Let's have Christensen at right back.
Yeah, I mean, I
feel really sorry for him.
Yeah, it just seems like they're stockpiling on defenders. But then it was such an important part of the team. Maybe he's thinking, we'll have one defence for Europe, one defence for the Premier League. We'll have to see. But on the flip side, we had a question for you, actually, on what's happening in North London. Someone's asked, why is it so hard for Arsenal to offload players? I mean, we were talking about the difference in squad size before. Frank Lampard reckons Arsenal have twice the size of the squad. Wenger said he wants to get rid of players. His squad's too big. Why are they struggling to move players on, James?
Wages, simple as that. And also, they're not being particularly flexible, as far as I understand it, on prices. So the one I've been following with a lot of interest, because I think he's a very good player, is Lucas Perez. My understanding is Arsenal want £13.4 million for a player they started, I think, six times last season and paid £17 million for. So not really kind of accepting much of a price cut. They're quite reluctant to let him go on loan, which is what Newcastle would like. And he's on high sort of tens of thousands in wages. Same with Gibbs. And I think, at the same time, a lot of it is just that these sort of players are more likely to go at the back end of the window because teams go, right, we need a left back. Who do we know we can get? Kieran Gibbs will chuck Arsenal. And I mean, for £10 million, that's a really good buy. Mm. Much the same as if you can kind of get Lucas Perez, if you're a Premier League team, for £13 million. It's a really good buy, but none of them are like particularly exciting, and they'll really, really struggle to get rid of Debushi, Jenkins, and they'd basically have to fund their wages to get rid of them.
I mean, Debushi is like haunting the Emirates now, isn't he?
He's just one of those players you'll probably look in December and think, is he still there?
I think I fought that last December.
Well, exactly, every year. Jack Wilshere as well, it's kind of gone quiet with him, and that's kind of a worry for him, because whereas players like Gibbs, you kind of know what you're getting, no real concerns about injuries. A mid-table club might think, yeah, we'll do that. We know we've got a solid left-back there. Wilshere, you don't know, unfortunately. Last season, he was generally stayed fit, but didn't really.
I think the Jack situation's a bit simpler than that, actually. I just think he loves Arsenal. He's got a year left on his contract, and there's no one rushing to give Arsenal silly money for him. I think if someone came in and said, we'll give you £20 million for Wilshere, and Wilshere wanted to go, Arsenal might go or accept the offer. But I mean, you know, this is the team Wilshere's supported since he stopped supporting West Ham at 7 or 8. And I don't think he
so
really
you're saying
wants...
he's off to West Ham?
He's not. He's not off to West Ham. Don't want him.
No.
But I think almost the solution there is he'll stay for a year and you see what happens.
Yeah.
He's from Arsenal's perspective, Wilshere back to his best is exactly what they need. So
yeah, but you know.
Oh yeah, I mean that's like that's like saying from Arsenal's perspective, Lionel Messi's exactly what he's not going to happen.
And Santi Cazorla doesn't have information problems and all the rest of it, isn't it really? But there were links earlier in the window, Greg, that Sampdoria wanted Jack Wilshere. How do you reckon he'd actually do in Italy if he made the move?
Yeah, probably quite well, I reckon. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see because that obviously used to be a well-trodden path in there.
The English Borja Valero, might you say?
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, why not? But he probably would because it is a bit more kind of time on the ball, you'd imagine. Yeah, as long as he was to stay fit and play a full season, I think he could kind of do well anywhere at that kind of level. But then you've obviously got to take into account all the off-field stuff and adapting to a new country. So maybe a bit of a risk he might be thinking. Not maybe a big enough club competing at a high enough level to take that risk. I don't know.
Genoa.
Best shirt, though.
Oh, yeah.
Best shirt.
It's a lovely city as well as Genoa, isn't it?
Yeah, on the coast. Yeah,
absolutely. Jack, you're missing out, mate. You're missing out. And just, I mean, we've drifted away from it a little bit, but the very last question on the Community Shield, and it's one for you, Greg. I mean, is this whole idea of the Community Shield being a big, glorified friendly, a little bit of a kind of a top six privileged position, looking down on this trophy? I don't mean to sound antagonistic and condescending, but as a Crystal Palace fan, if you would have won the FA Cup against Man United...
Remind me.
Would it have been appreciated going to Wembley for a curtain raiser at the start of the season? Even for fans of top six clubs, when I was tweeting out, oh, it's only a friendly, a lot of people got in touch with me saying, yeah, but it's a great day out at Wembley. We really enjoy it. It's good for the fans. Do you think maybe we're being unfair on the competition?
I think it can kind of be both. A friendly in the sense that if that's all you win this season and you're a big six club and you don't fulfil your ambitions in the main competitions, you're not going to be happy looking back. But yeah, of course it's a fun day out. And I think when you're there from a fan's perspective, Arsenal, Chelsea, you're going to want to win the game. I know for the managers, it's probably more about performance and what shape you're looking in ahead of the next weekend. I don't think you can treat it as a trophy as some managers would want to.
A treble completing trophy according to some, that's it.
Yeah, well, the Emirates Cup, Asia Trophy, they've already won. So, But at the same time, I don't think it's true that there's nothing can be drawn from this game because it's a week to go to the season. If a team is really not looking in good shape or conversely is, you can draw something from it. So kind of somewhere in the middle. Nice. Sit on the fence there.
Scrap it. Replace it with an all-star game.
Oh, Michael Cox was suggesting something like this on Twitter.
Was he?
Yeah.
It'd be so cool. And play it like the NBA play, not like, you know, play it like the NBA play their all-star game. So the goalkeepers are like there nominally. In fact, all-stars except the goalkeepers. conference
managers in goal.
Yes.
And then a multi-ball option instead of extra time. Yes. That would be incredible. On a positive note, because that's a positive note, I think it was nice that following the Grenfell Tower fire, they made that the focus on the kind of the Community Shield this season. It's easy to forget that it all began as a way to actually raise charity and have this nice little exhibition. So I thought that was a nice touch to kind of go back to its roots. But we're going to move on now to our next little feature of the Monday podcast. A new format, in case listeners might have noticed. Unheralded Hero of the Weekend. I want to know any players. I mean, you've already picked out Clinton NG as one. So I'm looking for somebody a bit different.
For this.
Maybe you should have done. But who was your unheralded hero on the pitch, if you can, at Wembley this weekend?
Oh, Wembley.
Or any other pictures that you might have been watching?
Yeah, I was going to go over to France, actually, or the Principality of Monaco, just because I thought Jemison was really good and wouldn't have unheralded, and it's understandable. But last season, just so many good young players, especially in attacking areas, that he kind of got overlooked a little bit. But if you look at Monaco's defensive record last season, it was actually really good. The goal scoring was what caught the eye. And again, Jemison here, he equalised to make it 1-1, Monaco went on to win 3-2, but also just his passing from the back. He's a bit older than I thought he was. He's 24, so not that old. But
that's no age for a centre back.
But for Monaco,
practically a veteran.
Yeah, got his first Brazil cap earlier this year, and obviously they've already qualified for the World Cup, so they might be a bit more open to giving players on the fringes like him a chance. So I think it could be a big season for him at Monaco.
Fabulous player, really like him. I'm surprised Man City haven't been even linked with it or any kind of. Any team in need of a centre-back, because he's, as you say, as Greg says, he's fantastic on the ball. you know,
silky.
Absolutely. Smooth as well.
Smooth and silky. That's how we like it. Who's your unheralded hero of the weekend, James?
It's probably the first time in a while that he's been a bit unheralded, but because of the sort of Kolasinac well-deserved loving, I don't think Rob Holding quite got the credit he deserved, for the first time ever. Didn't quite get the credit he deserved, but three games at Wembley, three wins, something like probably, you know, just about a dozen serious games for Arsenal now, and looks absolutely the making of a top quality young centre back. Another one who's very good on the ball, but also just for someone that I'm assuming, I didn't watch Bolton, but I'm assuming is not too comfortable as in a back three beforehand. He's so good when he has to track runners into the channels, so good at kind of hooking the long balls away, and just putting in a tackle at the right time. Looks fantastic. Would be surprised if he doesn't make the World Cup. Really would be surprised. I think he's going to be a starter for Arsenal. And I think they'd be mad to buy another centre-back because he's been brilliant.
I remember Wenger when he was, he's always under pressure, isn't he? But particularly at the start of last season, and they drew with Leicester 0-0 away, and Holding had obviously come in unexpected at the start of last season because of injuries, and Wenger was kind of in his press conference saying, I'm sorry he didn't cost £50 million, but he's a good player. But to be fair to him, that does look like a really good deal now. You've got a young English player who's going to be playing most weeks this season, I think.
Wenger loves him. If you ever want to get Arsenal in a good mood in a press conference, just ask him about Rob Holding. he'll be really nice and charming.
It kind of used to be the case with Callum Chambers a bit, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he just loves it when you talk to him about his defenders and how well they played. Except Gabriel, but at least.
He could be off, couldn't he?
I heard Valencia are interested. Take that money.
Take the money. And run. Speaking of unheralded heroes, well, before we get into this question, a few more for you. Granted, Xhaka got a lot of praise. You know, he's probably still a bit unheralded because he's a deep line playmaker. And as we know, they struggle to kind of get the praise they're due. But I think he was slightly at fault for the goal, wasn't he, for Chelsea? Kind of hoofed the ball back into his own box.
Yeah, not the best clearance, but that's not what you pay Xhaka for.
No.
I mean, he's an Arsenal midfielder. He can't defend.
And that shot that got turned around, oh. That would have been an absolute rocket at the start of the season.
There's a sort of... He is so polarizing. Kind of, there are people who still feel obliged to stick to their belief from early on that he's rubbish. Well, he was never that bad. He was never quite as good as the people that are now kind of saying.
I think
he was
that
good
when
along.
He first came in, the team was bad, and that didn't help.
I think so. He's clearly someone that, like a lot of Arsenal midfielders, having a third defender behind them helps him a lot. But he looks really good, really, 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 really good. Great on the ball. Has a really nice whipped cross and does a good line and impudent little chips. L1 triangles, he's great at them.
Beautiful.
I think with Lacazette as well, that could be a thing we see because Xhaka's so good at those long diagonals, isn't he? And obviously you've got an extra player running in behind. So.
And he also had a bit of a chance that looked quite spectacular. Didn't quite go in, didn't it, as well?
Looks good.
Should be some good football from Arsenal this season. But the question I was going to come to is, why aren't more clubs interested in Riyad Mahrez? The deals taken to Roma appears to be stalling. Previously, Arsenal were apparently interested in him. Why is no one going in for Mahrez, Greg?
Well, Leicester seem to be quite determined to stick out for the money they want for him, which is quite a high price. I think $50 million is what I think they'll probably budge on that as the window goes on. But I don't know. Leicester probably aren't making it easy. But then Arsenal as well. You're looking at them and thinking, is that what they need now? If Sanchez is going to stay, would Mahrez necessarily start every game? And I think if you're spending that money, even in this climate where it may seem a bit cheaper than before, it's a big ask.
Especially for Alex Iwobi, putting in those kind of performances.
Exactly. And I think if you look at Premier League clubs, Arsenal is the one you would naturally gravitate towards. And I think the other ones, if you look at Tottenham, they seem reluctant to, having been burnt a bit last summer with big last order signings. I think he'll still probably go, but yeah, it is looking the way where you wouldn't be maybe overly surprised if on the September the 1st he's still there.
I think Craig Shakespeare said he only wants a top six team, so inevitably that leaves only six teams and the odd European team.
Yeah.
But as Greg says, there's not that many teams that have got a real Mahrez-shaped hole in their team. Maybe Chelsea for me would be maybe the best fit, but Conte would have to work pretty hard to get him to track back. And then the rest don't really seem to fit. Maybe Man United, Greg? Maybe
as a Perisic alternative. But the thing is, he kind of does everything that all the United players already do. Like, I think Mourinho wants some guy that's going to get to the byline, not another one to dribble inside. So, yeah, probably doesn't even fit that either.
There's no team in the Premier League with a massive gaping Mario-shaped hole in their squad. And I don't know how desperate he would be to go to Italy without Champions League football. I'm like racking my brains now for any team that would like be like, yes, give us Mahrez.
I mean, Barcelona have got a gap on the left.
Yeah, true. Roma have lost Salah this summer, so they probably do need someone. But they're quite different players, so Salah's obviously just rapid and just a great kind of great in transition. Mahrez obviously a bit more technical in terms of the tight spaces there. So that would involve kind of a switch. And also, if you're looking at the money that Leicester are wanting, Salah wasn't a huge fee, really. So you think maybe not a great deal from Roma's point of view if they actually spent more on Salah's replacement, who's probably not quite as good.
It just makes you think that Mahrez completely dropped the ball last summer. That's when he should have gone. His price was the highest. Interest was highest.
Yeah. Same with Vardy as well.
Yeah.
Neither of them now would kind of... there's no top 16 that would be beating down Leicester's door for them.
He'll be well jealous of Drinkwater when he goes to Chelsea, aren't they? Oof. We're going to move on now to our next section, an action replay. I want you to pick out, not a goal, another highlight from the weekend, a pass, an attack, a tackle, a tactical switch, if you will, something that caught your eye over the weekend in football that you think needs a bit of attention. James?
I'm quite intrigued by a new tactic Amion displayed at kickoff against PSG.
You just stole mine.
And mine.
Well, we can all talk about it. Now that PSG are just so good, is the new thing just let's play for territory?
Yeah.
We can nick a goal if we pin them in the corner. Yeah, that was... So I guess for listeners that are unaware, Amion pinged the ball back from kickoff and then...
From the kickoff of the whole game, wasn't it?
They pinged it straight into PSG's corner flag. The only time I've ever seen that before is in... was at Shrewsbury Town for a season. A player who I can't remember and probably shouldn't name anyway used to do it, and we were all convinced it was... He used to put it in the corner and we were like, oh, he's got a bet on, hasn't he? Yeah. First throw within 1 second. He's got a bet on that. So maybe Amion... No, they don't. Amion don't.
Allegedly, all the rest of it. It's kind of... It's taken this anti-possession kind of tactical counter trend to a whole new level, hasn't it? Although Tony Evans, I did tweet it out on Twitter, and Tony Evans said, Everton were doing that in the 1990s. Okay. So.
It kind of... I only saw the first one, actually, from the very start of the game, and it kind of worked in that instant because they actually had possession after PSG had kind of been penned in, the old box them in Sunday lead tactic. But they actually had possession much higher up the pitch than they would have done if like, they'd kind of like gone back. So
Gagan Watford.
Yeah.
Like you know, Graham Taylor, but, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but with Gagan pressing. I'm using buzzwords now. But you know what I mean. They were trying to get him in close and win the ball as high close to their goal as possible.
The more you think about it, the more you think it kind of works, actually. Like, if I've got a couple of decent, chunky-sized midfielders that I can put to kind of press and win that challenge for that throw, well, at the very least, PSG are going to just have to thump the ball back to me upfield. Like,
and it's not that rare to see...
I'm liking it.
It's not that rare to see teams not quite go that far, but they kind of hit the ball in that area, still keep it in the pitch, and normally you win the throw-in because you're kind of hitting it to the opposition fullback, heads it out. It's kind of just the next step from that, isn't it? It could be revolutionary.
Young boys of Bern and Red Bull Salzburg do similar kind of tactics. That obviously not kicking it into touch as you were. But you're right, just basically creating these pressing traps inside your own defensive third, basically. Very interesting. And as Tony Evans and many other people picked out on Twitter, it's nothing new under the sun in football, but it's interesting that these ideas are coming back around again to gain prominence, as is always the case. We're going to move now to the week ahead. Usually we pick our games of the week to watch, but there's only really one big game, isn't there, this weekend, and it's the UEFA Super Cup between Real Madrid and Man United. Fresh from court, Ronaldo is in the squad despite not really featuring in pre-season much, as Zidane has named him. Does this mean more than the Community Shield, James?
No, it's Europe's Community Shield. they don't even put it on the badge, do they? It does have a really nice trophy. I remember that, but I don't even remember what the trophy looks like.
No, me neither.
Nice trophy, then.
I remember it being nice. Where is it this year?
It's in Macedonia, isn't it? Yeah.
It is in Skopje. Yeah. Exactly. It's just, it made more sense when it was in Monaco Stadium because it was kind of, that stadium is the perfect
representative. Why can't Macedonia host Blue
Ribbon
Because
they should
events?
Be getting the Europa League final.
Ah, I see.
It's just like, it was Monaco Stadium, like, it all looked kind of great and there was plenty of razzmatazz, but there was no one there. No one was watching.
And that's maybe more fitting is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's amazing that kind of the two biggest teams in world football are playing each other and no one cares, I guess, because they've just played each other. Which was the exact same thing at the Community Shield. Wasn't even sold out, because it was the fourth Arsenal-Chelsea game of 2017. And this is the second Real Madrid-Man United game of 2017, despite the fact that Man United didn't qualify for the Champions League.
We're all fans of narrative here, I assume. So Romelu Lukaku could be an interesting one. This was in this kind of fixture. Different teams.
Prove his calibre.
Yeah, missed the penalty under Mourinho and was quickly bombed out of Chelsea.
I know exactly. Well,
So, a few demons to...
Must count for Mourinho then.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, if they win.
Like we were talking about Conte, everything's intense. I think everything counts for Mourinho. Everything. It's like a bit in Game of Thrones where little thing is saying you must fight every battle at all times. That's basically Mourinho, isn't it? Doesn't let anything go.
He is basically little thing. He's got even got the graying sides.
I can't talk. I have now developed them. I am officially an old man. But we're going to move on now to our listener Q&A. Is there anything more we want to say about the Super Cup, really? I mean, it might be a fun spectacle, but it's...
Yeah,
I don't know. It's not really going to tell us anything, rather than a few bragging rights, is it?
No, not really. I think one thing which won't be new, but Mourinho, I think we know how he'll approach the game, kind of a reactive football, playing off Madrid's kind of mistakes. That was his approach in the big games last year in the Premier League as well, and it brought some success at times. But I think if they're going to win the league this year, he maybe have to do a bit more than that. So whether moving forward, he's going to be a bit more ambitious in some of these big games, which is probably what's going to be needed if they're going to, with the competition at the top now.
I guess what's interesting is Zidane has also shown an ability to set Real Madrid up to basically thrive off the other team's mistakes. He did that to great effect against Atletico Madrid, where basically it's like, oh, you guys like playing without the ball. Well, we're going to play without the ball. Let's see what you can do in possession. Oh, you're making loads of mistakes. We're going to win now. So maybe we might see something like that from Zidane. That might be an interesting
No one will have the ball then. Just in the middle of the pitch.
He'll just go, you have it. Yeah. It's like a reverse.
Keep punting it into the corners.
Exactly. We've seen the pioneers in France, now we're going to see it in the UEFA Super Cup. So one to look out for there. Now, just to finish the podcast, we're going to go to our listener Q&As. We had so many questions last week on the Friday podcast that I thought I'd bring back a few of the questions we didn't have time for. So off the top, which team in the top five leagues will go bust first due to transfer inflation, James? I think basically they're saying who's going to do a Leeds.
Well, I mean, I think there are already some reports floating around about AC Milan. They were very insistent that they could pay that Leonardo Bonucci's fee. But considering that they've also had three separate, the takeover was delayed on three separate occasions. Greg, you probably know better than me.
It went on for about a year.
There's got to be reason to be nervous there, but I suppose the likely answer is the kind of bubble that we're in now. If one team goes, it will not just be every single one, or nearly every single one following them. There are very few teams that would be set up, I think, to weather a major storm, bar maybe Man United and Arsenal.
So we basically got the banking crisis on a football pitch.
I mean, if something
as soon
happens,
as Northern Rock goes,
I mean, you talk to kind of people in the Premier League, and I don't think they're really expecting any kind of downturn in revenue this year. I mean, it's the number one. The Premier League is the number one global sporting league now, and you know the overseas rights are only going to grow and grow. And the Premier League will now effectively fund the other top five leagues. We're just going every summer, going, here's £50 million for your left back. What are you going to do about it? Oh, you'll go and get a better left back for £3 million. So, it's still a way off, I think.
We saw the bottom fallout of Serie A in the noughties, and when Zidane went to La Liga, and that completely messed with the landscape. Do you see anything like that happening to the Premier League anytime soon, Greg?
I think it's easy to get complacent with these things because it's such a big thing.
I was going to say, James saying, oh, they don't see any end to the growth, but you never see the end to the growth until you...
Well, exactly. Yeah. So naturally, instinctively, you kind of think, no, it'll be fine. Like they won't let that happen, but... Yeah, I wouldn't say I see it happening, but yeah, it's kind of moving to the direction where you're questioning, is this actually sustainable? Especially with the TV rights, there's obviously all the issues about viewership figures and different ways of watching or not watching, as a lot of people
Streaming kill or you know, make football? We'll have to see. To see for another time. Just on related to that point, Wenger has come out recently and said that big clubs have a disadvantage because of their pre-season commitments, touring around the world and all the rest of it. Do you think there's anything in that? Do you think big clubs are at a disadvantage because of pre-season?
No, not really. Not when you take the overall picture, because that pre-season and that brand is what kind of allows them in part to spend big fees, to get better players, to pay bigger wages. And it's not even the the big clubs that are doing this now, is maybe they have it to a greater extent, but I know that Palace, Leicester, West Brom, they all went to Hong Kong. So I think it's going to be a Premier League wide thing now. And I think, I don't think they're, in the grand scheme of things, I think the big clubs are probably getting a better deal.
I think the scales are a bit different for the big clubs though. So yeah, as you say, Palace and Leicester did the Premier League Asia Trophy, but it's kind of a week of your time. I was the one that asked Arsene about this, and I said to him, why don't you not go? To which he was like, I'm smart and I understand that money rules. But the reality is they've flown all the way to Australia and then done flown to Shanghai and Beijing. It's huge, huge amount of distance covered. And, you know, the players got ill. You saw that in the sort of the Chelsea game where half of them couldn't even walk, and because it's too much to take out of them. And I what wouldn't surprise me is I'll be really interested to see how West Ham get on against Man United on the opening weekend, because West Ham have done the classic, we're going to Austria and Germany for warmish weather
and high altitude
training, whereas Man United have kind of, it's not been the worst tour they've ever had, but crisscrossing across the United States and friendlies in Stavanger and Dublin and all that. I do think it gives smaller teams a sort of competitive advantage in the early weeks if they're not going on major globe-trotting endeavours. But yeah, as you say, it's not going to stop. But maybe they, I mean, yeah, it's not going to stop. And whatever you do, the clubs will find time to fit these tours in.
Well, that's the argument against winter breaks in the English league. Because you look at Germany, when's a winter break? Bayern often go and play friendlies during that time. Mm. And I think it might have been two seasons ago. It was a season when Wolfsburg were in the title race, I think. But they were the first team to face Bayern in the restarted league, and they absolutely trashed them. Because it looked like they spent their entire time preparing for this match while Bayern were off doing their promotional things.
And they do that. Teams do that if they get knocked out of the FA Cup early. Was it Man City? I might be misremembering, but someone went and played a friendly during the fifth round weekend.
Yeah.
I think Wenger's point would be kind of more valid in that winter break if that was the situation, because there would be then a clear choice. You've already got your summer stuff. You can opt out of it. And I think I'm not sure it's enough to, it's a whole other debate, the winter break, but I'm not sure that argument's enough to kind of counter all the advantages we bring.
As we often say on this podcast, want to come back to another time to do in a bit more depth. Move on to the next question. Which one position at each top six club do they need to reinforce in to win the league? So if we could quickly go for all six, what do you reckon? Who do you want to start with? Should we go alphabetically? Arsenal. Where does Arsenal need to reinforce in one position to win the league?
Box-to-box central midfielder. Jean-Michel Seri.
Yeah, we'll be good signing, yeah. Although Ramsey came good at the end of last season after his injury, so maybe he could be that guy. Mm.
But I guess ideally you would want a midfield of Cazorla and Xhaka. Cazorla is basically doing the dynamism and the playmaking. And Cazorla's not going to stay fit, so maybe Seri is the man to do that. Mm. Very good shout. Chelsea. Who do Chelsea need?
I'd probably say a midfielder again, because that is looking thin in there. I think if Christensen is going to be an option, as we spoke about earlier, I think they're all right at centre back. Batshuayi might be involved a bit more as an alternative to Morata. So probably a central midfielder. But as we touched on, it's hard sell because they're probably not going to start.
Maybe someone like Blaise Matuidi. He right once out of PSG. He might not want to start every game, but he'd be in the mix, surely.
He was the other one I was going to throw in for Arsenal, and I presume PSG have got to sell someone. He's getting on for 30, but he's got the skill set for the Premier League. Yeah, I would say CM or a push. I think you can upgrade on Pedro on that right flank.
Any names you want to throw in there?
Oh,
Riyad Mahrez.
No. If you fancy being fun, Ousmane Dembele. You got plenty of money.
Yikes. You have to beat Barcelona to that one. It could be Neymar money.
Yes,
again.
Do it. Everyone in Europe should conspire to beat Barcelona to all the players they want.
Moving on to Liverpool. I think we all know the answer to this one, don't we?
Centre back.
Yeah.
No, I think they need another striker.
Do you?
No, centre back.
It's got to be Van Dijk, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But if it's not Van Dijk, who are they going to get?
Well, yeah, just Liverpool in general. Their summer kind of, it started off really promisingly with Salah coming in quite early. And it looked like Van Dijk was going to get completed really early as well, get the whole pre-season with them. But
then they burnt their fingers.
Yeah, imagine if they don't get him now. And Kate is obviously off the agenda as well. So
I quite like the player that Greg flagged up earlier, Jemison. But not, neither of any
Monaco
none of
aren't
Liverpool
really keen to sell anyone else, are they? No.
So that'd be probably even more expensive than Van Dijk.
On to Man City now, and I think it's probably the same position, isn't it?
Yeah.
Same player.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Central midfielder as well, maybe not as urgent, but just a body, not someone. Maybe Danilo, I know he's earmarked him for kind of a versatile role, but
someone like Tolisso would have been perfect.
Yeah, with kind of Gundogan's injury history, Yaya Toure isn't too old to play every game now.
Mm. Maybe. And there's talk he might actually move into defence as well.
Yeah.
Ultimate
pep. You can definitely see that, can't you, in the home games, especially against the lower half teams.
Proper quarterback role.
Do it.
Manchester United, what do they need?
Well, there's a lot of fullback talk, isn't there? Left-back, maybe?
They have got about five left-backs, so none of them quite fit.
But I was going to say, because Aurier is like the guy who's been linked a lot, but
there's
Valencia,
conflicting reports on that.
Yeah. I don't know. I would have thought if it was right back, they would be looking for not someone to start, because Valencia was so good last year. Mm.
They just loaned out Fozzy Mensah as well.
Yeah. Perisic is the one Mourinho seems to really want, isn't it? So I suppose I'll trust him on this one and say...
Maybe Gareth Bale as an alternative?
Yeah, almost. I kind of think you could almost... There's a lot of positions where you could do better, but maybe you do actually... In the summer that Ed Woodward's kind of thought, I don't need a superstar, maybe the summer that you could do with a superstar, a Bale or... a Bale... Yeah,
Bale.
Get Gareth Bale, because you think that what's gonna stop winning Man United winning the league, their defense will be fine, particularly with Matic in front of it. But it feels like it'll be the same issue where they're gonna draw a lot of games 0-0 or 1-1. So a player like Gareth Bale is exactly what you need to change that. So yeah, they need Gareth Bale, the one summer they probably won't get him.
There we go. Which brings us to a nice link to Tottenham Hotspur. What do they need?
Clinton Ng.
Oh no, stop it.
But I think a player, a wide kind of, Zaha was someone they really wanted earlier in the summer, but that was off the agenda quite early. Lamella's still not fit, and we don't know how involved he will be when he is fit. And I think that, especially with a wide pitch at Wembley, that option off the bench, but same problem we've touched on before, it can be quite tough to sell that to players when they know they're not going to start in the first 11. But just need a sprinkling of depth all over the pitch, really, and right back as well is another area now where they seem a bit short.
I have a little feeling they're going to need a new central midfielder, because Moussa Dembélé...
Got the Cazorla's about him, hasn't he?
He has got a little Cazorla vibe coming off him, and if that's the case, that is probably the hardest of any kind of transfer business that any of the top six have to do, because I genuinely don't know of a player in Europe that's quite like Moussa Dembélé.
I don't know.
No, he's quite unique. But I think Pochettino really likes Harry Winks, doesn't he? So I think he was injured a little bit at last season. And they've obviously kept Dyer, Wanyama. So I think they'll probably be okay there.
Mm. Well, there you go. There's your answer. That's what every single member of the top six need to do to win the league. If they all do, who's going to win the league? We don't know. We'll have to find out.
Share the league like they do the Community Shield.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is a bit more of a left field one. Who do you think is most responsible for England's great summer? At youth level. Dan Ashworth? I'm going to give you a cheat sheet. But since he's coming as technical director, I'd probably say he's the man, isn't he?
The councils of South London? Look at where all those players come from. You know, I can't speak for the players in the women's game, and I do think that's quite separate. I think we just have a heritage on that does give us a bit of an advantage. But that under-20s team... There's a lot of very good players from Everton and, you know, from the Everton Academy who came through in Liverpool, but the sort of sprinkling of stardust, their best player, Ademola Lookman, if it hadn't been for sort of the fact that South London councils have just about kept football alive in that area, and they don't deserve much credit for anything else, we might not have won the under-20s World Cup, because so many brilliant, talented ball players, even players like Zaha, they're all coming through from Lambeth and Southwark.
All about the cages.
All about cage, and we, you know, I think that the future for England is cage football on a big pitch. I bet you didn't think I'd say that.
I'm happy to say it because I love watching it. Dele Alli is probably the prototypical example of that style of play. Any other thoughts on that, Greg?
Dan Ashworth's a good shout. Can't really better that or James's answer. So,
We always talk about how we want to bring street football back into the game, and I guess that is the way you do it, by playing street football. Mm.
Yeah,
there you go.
You could be on something there, Greg.
Possibly. A very final question: has the £1 billion player been born yet?
And can he swim faster than a shark?
Ask me to do a bit of maths there, aren't you? Which is never a good proposition with me. I would say no, just because of what we spoke about with the bubble bursting.
Yeah,
still a long. it's over double Neymar, isn't it? Over double the previous record. So that's a huge leap. Yeah. But to get to a billion, that's a long way down the line, you'd think. But
I mean, Neymar was more than double Pogba, who was the previous record holder.
That's what I mean. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, which hasn't happened that much throughout history. That sharp climb, but. I still think Neymar will be the record for a few years now, unless PSG do something similar.
There was a really interesting graph that was going around on Twitter, I think, last night, looking at, I think they just put the transfer market on some kind of like scale, and it was by powers of 10. So even though the graph looked quite linear, it actually wasn't. It was a huge, massive upturn. But if you follow the current trend, we should apparently get the first £1 billion transfer in the 2030s.
Well,
do you buy that?
I can see that. Yeah, I can see that. I don't want to kind of be the tulip seller in Amsterdam. In I was studying that before Jonathan Wilson wrote an article on it. I wouldn't necessarily rule it out. I do think if you take it on a different scale, I do think we certainly have several players now who will be the first players to. The players that will follow Michael Jordan as £1 billion sportsmen. I think we've got several. I don't know what Messi, Ronaldo and Neymar's current net worth is, but I think all three of them will end up having earned £1 billion, which is remarkable.
What I was going to say is, well, we don't know what their tax situation and offshore developments
are. Let's not talk about that.
Yeah, let's definitely talk about that. But you know what I mean? Let's not talk about that. That's probably what we've got time for. Probably for the best we've got time for before I put myself into court. James, thank you very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Anything you've got on this weekend that you want to tell our listeners about?
I will be, hopefully, at Arsenal-Leicester on Friday. Friday night football to open the Premier League is disgusting me. But do please join me on the
it's
standards
awful. Please
website.
Join me.
help me. And the worst thing is I have to work Sunday as well, so I don't even get a full weekend.
Listeners, if you're following James on Twitter, please send him all the violins after this.
Please. That's it's a tough life, isn't it, having to go to football games.
Absolutely terrible. Greg, what have you got on this week? And thank you for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Greg. Thank you for having me. I'll be at Palace Huddersfield this weekend, hopefully. Which should be quite fun. I think Huddersfield have definitely got one of those teams who are going to fly out of the traps and look quite good in the first few months. So,
two very interesting new managers for the Premier League as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm. High hopes for De Boer?
Yeah. What that amounts to in lead position is hard because the big seven are stuck there. So, we'll see.
We've got Loftus-Cheek, got Fosu-Mensah, got all the double-barreled names. So that can
dreams of 10th.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Dreams of 10th. Sure, that's a difficult second album by a band. But anyway, that's all we've got time for today. Thank you so much for your questions, and we'll be back again later this week to preview the first weekend of Premier League football of the season. Cheers, join us, and see you again soon.